This is 9/11 Freefall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Guest tonight is Dana Carson. He's the other guy who was in the room last week with me when we went to an event at which Michael Shermer was speaking. Michael Shermer is a professional skeptic, somebody who is skeptical of things and writes books about being a skeptic and sells them. And he was there that night doing the same. He wasn't very pleased with some 9/11 truth literature that was being handed out outside. And then in his attempt to try to debunk the 9/11 conspiracy theory, he got his facts wrong. So we had to publicly call him out on that right at that event. Made for an interesting exchange. Very interesting to watch Michael Shermer try to divert the question away from science and to ridicule and sarcasm. But it didn't work. I think a lot of people in the audience recognize what he was doing, and I don't think he came out looking very good at all. So we'll be going over that tonight. Stay tuned. I'll be playing that later on in the hour. Here's something that fell off my radar. I'm going to read it to you now. This article was just published on January 13th, 2016, according to the website. The site is colorado911truth.org. It's by Marty Hopper. It says, "We applaud the Boulder Weekly, an independent newspaper in Boulder, Colorado, for recently publishing a letter to the editor criticizing their lack of coverage of 9/11 truth. Here's a letter which was printed on December 10th, 2015. So the Boulder Weekly published this on that day. I'll read it word for word. Who is the real censor? It's a shame that Tim Redman's recent article on Project Censored chose to start out by denigrating the 9/11 truth movement. Mr. Redman states that the current authors of Project Censored have veered at times into the world of conspiracies and 9/11 truther folks. By truther folks, I wonder if Mr. Redman is referring to the 220 senior U.S. military and intelligence officers, law enforcement veterans, and government officials who expressed significant criticism of the 9/11 Commission report or have made public statements that contradict that report. Or perhaps he's referring to the 2,393 licensed architects and engineers who are demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers, since the official story defies the most basic laws of physics. See AE911truth.org. Or maybe truther folks include the thousands of firefighters, scientists, pilots, doctors, and other professionals who question the official story. It's especially shameful that a supposedly independent journalist writing about media censorship himself discounts any story associated with the word conspiracy. Isn't the government's story that 9/11 was perpetrated by 19 Arab terrorists under the control of Osama bin Laden itself a conspiracy theory? Volumes have been written, including peer-reviewed scientific articles, disproving the government's version of the events of 9/11. Yet 14 years later, media censorship remains the primary obstacle to educating the public about the available science surrounding 9/11. Truth movement advocates have requested that Boulder Weekly examine and write about this evidence, but the response to date has been silence. Perhaps Mr. Redman and Boulder Weekly would do well to look under their own hood when it comes to the suppression of information which, as the founder of Project Censored stated, prevents the public from fully knowing what is happening in the world." That, again, is written by Marty Hopper, great activist, great person out there in Boulder, Colorado. Again, the group is Colorado 9/11 Truth, and they got an event coming up here on January the 23rd, where they're going to be talking about 9/11 science, truth issues, other issues associated with 9/11. So you can go to that website and find out more about that. But this is what you do, folks. I've talked about this so many times here on this show. All right, when they call you out, when they make these little jabs, use the resources that are available to you. Use your pen. Use your First Amendment. Use it or lose it. All right, and in this case, they did it. They wrote the letter to the editor, sent it in, and it was published. You just got to try. You just got to throw rocks at the beast. See if you can hit that sweet spot. And again, if a lot of people do this, if many people, you know, go out and just, you don't have to be the best writer in the world. Just get it down on paper. Maybe you got a friend that is an English teacher or is just a good writer themselves. They can proofread it for you. But send it in, be accurate, check your facts, and just get it in front of the eyes and minds of all the people in your community. We need to be having these discussions in every corner of America, every corner of the world. So the discussion tonight with Dana Carson is going to focus on our exchange with Michael Shermer. And a big part of that was when I confronted him and asked, how does the top part of a building crush the lower part without slowing down? Of course, this is in reference to NIST's pile driver theory that they used to try to justify why that building was totally demolished on that day. Not just the one building, but both of them, the Twin Towers. So I wanted to explore that a little bit more deeply. And sometimes I've done this before on the show where we read from Beyond Misinformation. And this is something that is going quick. Many people are buying it, spreading it around, getting the word out to as many people as they can. And this is opening a lot of eyes around America, folks. Like I say all the time, just because the New York Times isn't telling you about it doesn't mean it isn't happening. I see it myself. Many people buying them. This is being distributed by volunteers in the 9/11 Truth Movement to those in our society with the credentials to do something about it. And some aren't ready to come out of the closet yet, but just, you know, privately saying, yeah, my eyes are opened. I don't know what to do with this information. That's the first step. Eventually they will know what to do with the information, but you got to wake them up first. So I'm going to read to you about this aspect of the evidence. This is on page 19. The section is providing a full explanation of the total collapse. It begins, while NIST acknowledges being unable to provide a full explanation of the total collapse, other researchers on both sides of the issue have analyzed the question extensively through methods other than computer modeling. A number of papers supporting the hypothesis of controlled demolition have measured the fall of World Trade Center 1's upper section and have observed that it never slowed down in the 4 seconds before it disappeared from view. Rather, its acceleration remained constant at approximately 64% of free fall, and there was never an observable deceleration, which would be required if the upper section had impacted and crushed the lower structure. A lack of deceleration would indicate with absolute certainty that the lower structure was destroyed by another force before the upper section reached it. In January 2011, the ASCE's Journal of Engineering Mechanics published a paper by Dr. Zednik Bazant and Jia Lang Li titled Why the Observed Motion History of the World Trade Center Towers is Smooth. This paper was a response to The Missing Jolt, a simple refutation of the NIST-Bazant collapse hypothesis, a paper critiquing Bazant's earlier work attempting to explain why the lower structures provided so little resistance to the upper sections. In the 2011 paper, Bazant and Lee claimed that the deceleration of World Trade Center 1's upper section was far too small to be perceptible, thus accounting for why the observed motion is smooth. Anthony Zambodi, a mechanical engineer and one of the authors of The Missing Jolt, and Richard Johns, a professor of philosophy and science, submitted a discussion paper in May 2011 arguing that Bazant and Lee used incorrect values for the resistance of the columns, for the lower structure's floor mass, and for the upper section's total mass. By simply correcting the values, Zambodi and Johns argued that Bazant and Lee's analysis actually proves that the deceleration of the upper section would be significant, and then in parentheses it says if demolition were not involved, and that the collapse would arrest in about 3 seconds. While the Journal of Engineering Mechanics inexplicably rejected Zambodi and John's discussion paper as out of scope, Zambodi, Johns, and Dr. Gregory Zoledzinski, a world-renowned expert in structural mechanics, were able to publish a paper addressing Bazant and Lee's analysis in the International Journal of Protective Structures titled Some Misunderstandings Related to the World Trade Center Collapse Analysis. Today, Bazant and Lee's paper is the sole piece of analysis upon which the official hypothesis explanation for the total collapse of World Trade Center 1 and 2 rests. By rejecting Zambodi and John's discussion paper, the Journal of Engineering Mechanics has suppressed criticism of Bazant and Lee's paper within its walls. But the papers discussed herein, published elsewhere, argue compellingly that the constant acceleration and the lack of observable deceleration by themselves constitute irrefutable evidence that explosives were used to destroy World Trade Center 1 and 2. And then at the bottom of page 19, it's got a little section explaining in a little bit more detail some of the trouble that Zambodi and Johns had in trying to get their paper published. Some of the hoops that people in this movement are required to jump through in order to get any real information in front of the eyes and minds of the general public. But it's par for the course, people. We are used to it. We are toughened. Our skin is hardened. It's like leather now, mentally, not literally. And the truth will out, just as Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur said when she was asked about Building 7 on C-SPAN's Washington Journal a few years ago. There's so much wisdom in that. Eventually, no matter what, no matter how much propaganda is thrown at a particular issue, no matter how much money is spent trying to suppress something, people become aware. You chip away at the walls that surround this lie, and they will come crumbling down when the general public is ready to accept it. Sometimes it's like coming out of the darkness and into the light. If you've been in a dark room for a number of hours, let's say you're a prisoner and you're thrown into the hole, you have to spend a week in there, total darkness with nothing but your thoughts to keep you company. When you come out into the sunlight, the sun is going to hurt your eyes. You can't take it in all at once. You got to squint your eyes and let them slowly readjust. That is how this information sometimes works with some people. Maybe they can't accept it at first, but when the truth is presented, when the information is laid bare, when people use their own common sense, when they apply the laws of physics, it becomes clear. And then they have to slowly face it, slowly deal with the ramifications of it. And we are doing that as a country. We are making those strides to becoming the kind of intellectually honest and mentally strong people we always claim to be. And a large part of that, of course, is because of this audience, people getting the information out there, doing whatever they can constantly for the last decade to right this wrong, right this tremendous injustice that we are still living with here as we approach 15 years after the event took place. That is why we do this work, and that is why we're going to continue marching forward and basically coming up with new, clever, and exciting ways to keep this issue alive and keep the public educated about what really happened on September 11th, 2001, to the buildings in New York, the World Trade Center Towers 1, 2, and 7, because they were brought down and controlled demolitions that day. All right, before I play my interview with Dana Carson, we're going to do what we do every week. We're going to take 10 seconds of silence to remember the victims of 9/11, their families, and all the people who died in the wars that followed 9/11. We're going to do that beginning now. And that is 10 seconds.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Dana Carson is a member of the Northern California 9/11 Truth Alliance. He's going to help me share a story tonight about a little back and forth that took place in Berkeley last week with a so-called skeptic Michael Shermer. Dana, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So before we get into all of that and share the adventure that we had, I want the audience to know more about you, introduce you to the listeners. So tell us particularly how you got into 9/11, the controlled demolition issue, and what made you start speaking out about it.
First of all, my background is a master's and bachelor's degree in geology, and I've been working as a something like a surveyor, but called a surveyor for the last 15 years. And if you'll count the years, you'll see that that puts me at the beginning of the job I currently hold, just about 1 year before 9/11 happened. So it was on an early morning on the way to work that I heard the first rumblings of what was going on. And unlike with the JFK assassination, you can't say, where were you when you heard about ... No, because with 9/11, the events unfolded for about half of the day, so you can't specify exactly where you were or what you were doing. But in any case, I my only concerns at the time that it happened was that I didn't like the guy who was in the White House, and I thought this is going to give him great ammunition to destroy the national parks or do whatever other anti-environmental activism that he might be inclined to do. And that was as far as I went with it. I hadn't foreseen that it would result in getting into the war in Iraq. And then it was in 2003, in conjunction with a small street corner vigil there, that I first was acquainted with the idea that 9/11 itself might be a problem. And when I finally had a chance to really look it through, I thought, well, there's some interesting stuff here, but I don't know if any of it's true. But then when I finally got around to seeing the actual image footage of the collapse of Building 7, I was well aware of what a building demolition was, what it could accomplish that could be accomplished in no other way, and what it took to prepare for it. So I was instantly converted from never having thought twice about a conspiracy theory into becoming an absolutely committed truther within 7 seconds. That's how quick it happened for me.
That is a good way of saying it. Within 7 seconds, you woke up and became a quote-unquote truther.
And I'm not afraid of that term. If the opposite of it is a liar, let's just use it. They want to give us a name, let's take it.
Well, I mean, I think it is so telling that the word truth is used in a slur against a certain group of people now that are simply talking about physics and common sense. This is like some kind of dystopian novel we're living here, some kind of thing written by, who's the guy who wrote 1984? Orwell.
What was the primary focus of Orwell's 1984? Everybody focuses on the torture and the tyranny and everything else. The real story of 1984 was the diminution and destruction of the ability to communicate through language. That was the real message. It was the Ministry of Truth, the propaganda, the dismissing of reality, even when reality was defined as set in stone. 2 + 2 = 5, and you will believe it.
That's right, and that is so applicable. Go ahead.
It is applicable because instead of 2 + 2 = 5, we're being told that 1 + 1 = 3. It's really the same.
Well, we're being told that 105 feet of free fall means nothing, that this is not a sign of controlled demolition, that somehow physics stood down on the day of 9/11. People always, you know, ask where certain defenses were and all that. I say, where were our physics? Well, physics was fine on that day. We have overwhelming evidence that these buildings were brought down in controlled demolitions. And yet, in a very shoddy way, the arguments are dismissed, are overlooked. We're going to get into that later in this latest example that we witnessed. I don't even know if there's a recording of it anywhere. But this has been
I haven't seen any of it.
Yeah, I'm going to look for it too. I've tried to some extent when I've had time over the past week. But this has been par for the course for the past however long the 9/11 truth movement has existed. You want to say realistically maybe 2005 when it started getting some legs under it. This has been par for the course.
I think it had a lot of groundwork to prepare before it ever started gaining any credibility. It had to go through some very hard years of having nobody pay any attention. That was just part of the deal.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if I've ever told this story on the air before, but within a few days of 9/11 happening, I had a friend who forwarded me an email of somebody somewhere, and I wish I could remember more details because I didn't really pay much attention to it, saying that the buildings had to have been brought down in a controlled demolition and calling into question the 9/11 story, and I sort of politely dismissed it. That was the mindset that I was in. At that time,
I think everybody has a story just like that.
Exactly, and that's the mindset that America was in. So it does take time to properly educate people, and then once they're educated, that's when they can start doing the work of trying to do something to overturn this tremendous wrong that was done. So with Northern California 9/11 Truth Alliance, and I went to my first meeting with you guys a few weeks ago. What are some of the things that you know, you guys have been doing over the years? What kind of activities do you do to spread awareness?
Well, the group meets, and it's usually fairly small, but it has gotten up to 35 and 40 attendees when there was something really interesting to discuss. But our main focus is to try to organize events in which we create high visibility to this issue, knowing full well that we're going to get pummeled by the public for being out there saying something about it. And we plan out actions involving sometimes piggybacking onto other people's protests, sometimes working to, you know, just try to create visibility for the issue. And we also work as in a form of solidarity, so that we compare notes and figure out what's working, what's not, and try to get a sense of, you know, how to communicate better, how to learn more. And we always encourage people to share new things that they've discovered. And it seems that 9/11 is a bottomless well of new information almost every day, if you're willing to look for it.
Yeah, and you know, I was just talking to somebody earlier in the day who was feeling a little bit down about the situation in our country right now, particularly with the 9/11 issue. And something that I had to stress is, you know, there is no manual for doing something like this. There is no handbook for how to overcome a tremendous lie, just so blatant where they can just deny basic scientific principles to try to shove through an official story.
Which is essentially what they've done. I mean, they've literally denied basic physics. And then they've turned around and tried to say, well, you know, there's this physicist that says such and such. Well, here's my analogy for that. It may not be true in economics or history or social studies or English literature or much of anything else, but in the case of math and physics, an eighth grade text is God. Nobody refutes the eighth grade text of a physics or math book. They are written in stone. The principles are well known. There is nobody out there who is going to try to refute anything that is claimed in a basic physics book. It's all been understood and studied. So when you have a resource like that, and you know for a fact that nobody can overturn anything that is said in that textbook, you now have a weapon that bypasses their experts. If I'm standing out with an umbrella in the rain, and all of a sudden I start getting pummeled by golf ball and baseball-sized hailstones, I don't need a meteorologist to tell me that it's just rain. And that's exactly what we've got.
That is a good way you put that there. I see that as an opening statement in the beginning of a textbook someday after we've exposed this, after we've come forward and acknowledged what really happened on 9/11 and the importance of learning basic physics, basic scientific principles. This is going to be a good wake-up call to the middle schoolers of why they need to pay attention on those sleepy afternoons when they're sitting in those classes learning these things, because you said it perfect right there. These concepts can be learned in an eighth grade physics book. You can't really argue with it.
And it turns out I've got a cousin who's been brainwashed into believing the official story by insistent parents who basically dismiss me as doing too much of this or too much of that as the reason why I might think something like I do. But this kid has now graduated in physics, and the next time I see him, that is exactly going to be the source of my challenge. Hey, I got a physics problem for you, and you can't back out of it. You have to either answer it or tell me why you can't or won't answer it. I don't think anybody can weasel out of that, and especially when they're being challenged in their field. So, you know, you just live and learn. You get pushed around, knocked around by the way things happen, and you learn something each time. And I've gotten to the point where I can pop off a very fast retort, usually perfectly timed and appropriate, to somebody who dismisses something I have to say. But it's taken time.
Well, it's just basically understanding what you're talking about, and this was part of the issue with Michael Shermer. So I'm going to set the stage a little bit here for the audience, because I'm not sure how much of a time I'm going to have for an intro on this, but there was an event, Michael Shermer, who I was only very mildly aware of before this, but there were people, here at AE who were interested in going and handing out literature outside the event, because apparently Michael Shermer is somebody who is a professional skeptic, somebody that is skeptical of things and has made a career out of it selling books, and people listen to him for some reason, and that's what they do. That's their bread and butter. And
it's an honorable profession.
Well, I mean, it's honorable if you're truly skeptical, and obviously you should be skeptical of claims that come up and put it through the scientific method. I believe that was a big part of his speech, and there were many things that I didn't disagree with, basic common sense stuff, but then I didn't see it being followed in what was being said. Now, I went down there, and my sole intention, I almost didn't even go to this, but my sole intention was to have them read a question. I was told by people who have been to these kind of events before, the network that was putting on the event is well known here in the Bay Area, and they had said that previous speakers, you write down your question and they read it. So I had written out a question already. I had to just rewrite it on the paper. And that was my basic intention. I put on a tie, I looked professional, and I that was really all I wanted to do. But essentially, when he got into his speech, he had been handed some literature by people. Some people, I guess, may not even have known what he looked like, and handed him some of the 9/11 truth material. So he started talking about it. And one of the first things I noticed is that when he started to try to explain what happened to the towers, he was getting his facts wrong. He started to describe it as a pancake collapse. And I don't know who shot first, you or me. I didn't expect to even have this kind of exchange. It just, you know, people say things happen unexpectedly. They might just suddenly say something without expecting to do it. And so I did. I mean, I just said, dude, that's not right. That's not what the official story was. I'll let you go ahead and describe it from your view of what happened, what transpired next.
Well, yeah. And just for a little bit more of a background on Mr. Shermer, he's been, I actually followed him, you know, paid attention to his columns in Scientific American and elsewhere, and placed him in a pretty high place of respect because of you know, how he had demonstrated the very things that he, you know, puts out there as a virtue. But this time he wasn't doing that, and this is why it brought it to my attention. So what I recall is that, yes, he started talking about pancake collapses, which, you know, and he was dismissive when somebody pointed out that that did not agree with the government report. Instead of taking the cue to understand that if you don't even agree with the government report, how are you actually helping their case? He instead tried to turn it on us by saying, oh, now you believe in the government report. No, that wasn't the point. So for me, when he started talking about pancake collapses, I just had one little word in my hip pocket that I could say quick enough and loud enough to get through the screening, and just said, nope, and let that be heard all throughout the audience, which is, you know, essentially what somebody from Code Pink might do if they didn't like what was being said.
Well, and I described what actually the government story was. I described it to the audience. And
government story is even more ludicrous than pancaking. I mean, to actually look at what the government is trying to say, they're not trying to have it both ways at once. They're trying to have it 15 different ways at once, every one of them contradictory.
The problem is that when this top block, because the government story is not a pancake collapse, particularly where are the floors stacked up on top of each other at ground zero. So the government has to exercise some common sense when selling their false official story. They had to abandon that, and they had to go with this pile driver explanation, which is that this top block acted as a pile driver driving the bottom, larger bottom portion all the way to the ground.
It doesn't fit with any of the physical observations. It's just a claim that's made. It doesn't bear any import whatsoever onto reality.
Right. And so the problem is that Tony Zambodi's paper shows that there's no jolt as the bottom, or as the top part hits the bottom part. There's no deceleration as this top block hits it. So how does the top part of a building crush the lower part without slowing down? And now I can't remember the exact dialogue that happened, but at one point during this exchange, I pointed out to the audience that this man doesn't even have his facts straight. How can he claim to be debunking something and present himself as an authority on the issue? And it'd be one thing if he said, I don't know. That would be acceptable, but he's claiming that he's able to debunk this, but he doesn't even have his basic facts straight on the story that he's trying to defend. And then he tried to divert it when I asked him, how does the top part of a building crush the lower part without slowing down? He didn't. What, remember his answer on that?
Well, I remember his answer, but I also remember this. He read my question, Mr. Mulder, he read my question through, and then read your question through, and then the answer. And my question was specifically, what changed between the draft and final reports on Building 7 regarding the collapse of Building 7? That was my question. It was a question that left absolutely no room for any obfuscation. The only thing it left was for you to either say, what changed is that they admitted free fall, or what changed is, I don't know what changed. Those are your options. And he ran off on some tirade about umbrellas and JFK and Hitler, you know, reaching back 50 plus years to try to find something to impugn our character for asking very specific, easily answered questions about 9/11, not JFK.
Well, that's what, and that was later when they actually read the questions, but during the exchange, he did the same thing. He proceeded to ask me, do you believe that, so I just remember the words Columbus, Turkey, and something else, and some other events that happened. Do you believe these are all conspiracies? When I asked, how does the top part of a building crush the lower part without slowing down? I think that was the point at which...
Each one of, and I spoke up, even though I wasn't authorized to do so. I said, each one of those is a separate investigation that can be judged only on its own merits. They cannot be collectively compared.
Well, and the thing I pointed out, he's diverting the question. This is a way of avoiding the question.
Avoiding a question he cannot answer, and he's doing it in a way that completely undermines his own claims as to how he advocates that we should all be able to think. The truth of the matter is, we are the skeptics. He's the one representing officialdom and orthodoxy, trying to put us down. We're the ones doing what he says we should do, but he isn't doing what he says we should do. It's
well, no.
A pure act of utter hypocrisy.
I know, and after going through a whole speech about how you have to follow the scientific method and all of this, and he...
Exactly what we have all been doing.
Well, yeah. And see, he diverted the question, and I pointed that I wasn't permitted to speak either. And normally, folks, I don't do these things. I don't interrupt people. But the fact is, 3,000 people died on 9/11. He's got an audience there who paid $15 to come in there and listen to him speak on the premise that he actually knows what he's talking about. And he is sitting here pushing misinformation. We got a book called Beyond Misinformation right now that is being distributed all over America. And
I hope somebody gave him a copy of it, even though I don't think he'll look at it.
Somebody did. He had a copy of it when he went up.
Then if he's even a fraction the intellect he claims to be, the next time he talks to you or anybody else about this subject, he will know exactly what that book says. Because that is certainly what I have done for his magazine and any other dismissive debunking literature about 9/11, I grab that with both hands and read it cover to cover so that I know who I'm talking to and what they're going to say. He's really as smart as he claims. He will do the same thing. But there's a difference. The difference is we're right and he's wrong. So when he tries to investigate us critically that way, he will fail. That's a problem for him.
And folks, I just want to stress here. Look, it's not that I really even care what Michael Shermer thinks. I barely knew who he was going into this event. It's just that I have these moments sometimes when I'm just so surprised, where I'm so taken back by how, like in this case, I was taken back by how weak his argument was, how little he actually knew, but he's projecting himself as somebody that has some inside knowledge. Or not even inside knowledge, but just general knowledge of the topic, and he's giving wrong information, and people are listening to this
information
person.
That's been discredited even by the official reports.
Well, exactly, and so that's why I'm highlighting this, because it's an interesting thing that happened, and I was there, and I can talk about it and participated in it. But it's also too just shows the feet of clay on which a lot of these people who make their living selling books, pretending that they have some knowledge that they can bestow on the general public and try to dismiss the very real evidence that we talk about.
Very reminiscent of these people that are constantly being trotted out on the evening news as so-called terrorism experts. How many times have you heard that? Oh, well, here's General John Smith, terrorism expert. And then what's he going to do? He's going to get up there and tells you that terrorists are dangerous. Sorry, pal, you're not a terrorism expert. You're just a guy.
Well, that's the case. That's the thing here. And, you know, we're having fun kind of remembering this. I kind of feel like we were in a battle together.
Well, that's because it's fun being in the 9/11 truth movement.
Well, it is, because the whole
thing. You have the right attitude to enjoy it. Otherwise, you're going to get beat down by it.
Well, yeah. And see, that's the thing is that, like, you know, I didn't go into this intending to interrupt this guy's lecture. And I didn't yell or anything. I was perfectly calm. And
I did intend to interrupt. Have to admit.
Okay. Well, you know, but just, I was just taken back by how this guy handled this. And by, you know, I ask a basic physics question and he goes on to ask me if I think all of these things throughout history are conspiracies and how obvious that is. And I would hope that any outside observer would recognize that. And then later on, this was the question that I asked. I wrote it out ahead of time. That's how I operate. I asked this and the guy read it on the stage. You have been critical of those who seek a new investigation into the destruction of World Trade Center 7 on 9/11. It's been discovered through Freedom of Information Act requests that the National Institute of Standards and Technology's analysis omitted critical features of World Trade Center 7's design that, when included, makes their theory of what initiated the collapse impossible. What harm could it cause for NIST to simply rerun the analysis with the proper features included in order to gain a more accurate and complete assessment of what brought it down? Now, I'm sorry, but when I had a person on here to debate me about 9/11, like a year ago or so, he was a very nice guy. You know, he has a different view of 9/11, but he was a nice guy and could actually try to formulate an argument and, you know, have a back and forth. He agreed that they should rerun the analysis just, you know, to get the features right. Or I think it was just an essentially, without speaking for him, but I got the feeling it was just in the spirit of science that they should rerun it.
Yeah, or just to shut up the truthers.
Well, because this is such a reasonable question, how could you say no to it? Especially since they got the analysis wrong and left out
your right, and I'm sorry, not just wrong, but wrong with deliberate and malicious dishonesty. The sheer studs were there, and the information was available to them, but they lied about it.
Well, regardless, I mean, the fact that we found this flaw in this analysis and this, you know, calculations and what they didn't include, they should rerun it. I mean, this is just basic common sense stuff. I haven't heard a rational argument as to why they shouldn't do that. Even if you want to believe that the official story is true, why not get it right? Why not get a better understanding of what...
I'll give you an exceptionally good rationalization for not wanting to do it. You work 5 years to construct a fraudulent explanation for something that is easily explained. The last thing you, when you're done with that job, it's like you have to write a homework assignment and every word in it has to be a lie. The last thing you want to do once you're done with it is to reopen it in any form whatsoever, because the whole thing was dishonest to begin with. They don't want to go out and have to have their lie exhumed again and examined again. They want it to be buried and dead. So I'll give you their rationalization for not wanting any of this stuff dredged up again, because A, it's going to make them look bad and potentially criminally liable, and B, they know that there is no defense for their, if it is subjected to the kind of scrutiny that you and I and any other skeptic would advocate, it will not stand, it won't pass muster. So of course they don't want to rerun any of their tests or even be honest about them. And I imagine that they were quite thrilled when they saw that after they released their 5,000-page report, it barely made 2 column inches in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I bet it wasn't much better in any other paper.
I know, this unprecedented event. Again, no steel frame high-rise has ever collapsed because of a fire before or after 9/11. This should be studied and prevented from ever happening again. I've said this a million times on the show. The fact that a lot of architects and engineers have never even heard of this building before is like doctors not knowing about the Black Plague. This is something that they should be fully aware of and studying, and essentially just to make buildings safer. Like,
but we know that those buildings were perfectly safe. There was nothing wrong with them. There was no reason they ever should have collapsed, any of them. Even the ones that were hit by planes never would have collapsed without help. So, yeah, so of course they're trying to come up with an ad hoc explanation for something that they only want to have to use once. They don't want to be able to say or have anybody say that they invented a new method for building destruction, because now they'll suddenly have to start worrying about it with all these new constructions, even though we all know it's bogus. So, you know, much better to just have the story quietly disappear.
Well, and see, that's another issue, too, that has been brought up by Dale Pierce, who used to be a firefighter, is that according to the official story, a few thermally expanding beams can cause an entire steel frame high-rise to fall in 7 seconds. Now, had there been firefighters battling these fightable fires in this building, they would have been dead. So now we've got a firefighter safety hazard that hasn't been dealt with. And we got firefighters.
Believe anything they're telling you, but of course we don't.
Well, you know, it kind of reminds me of that Seinfeld episode where George lied about something, and these people know it, so they're playing him on his lie, and he's driving them out into the, because he tells them he has a house and with a horse and stuff, and they're riding out into the woods and because they want to see the house, and finally he has to give up and say, okay, there is no house, there's no horse.
Exactly, and it's all encapsulated in an old saying that says, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. You can only carry a lie so far before a curious enough person will quickly ferret out the fact that you're lying. I mean, try to imagine what it must be like to live under deep cover, and every statement you make is potentially going to expose your cover. That's what these people have to deal with. Volunteering unnecessarily to try to ride a falsehood into the sunset like that would just be suicidally stupid.
Right, and it's fun, though, just to get nuts. Okay, so now how are we going to deal with the firefighter safety issue? The fact that these buildings can come crashing down in 7 seconds. Let's get nuts. Let's do it.
Yeah, sooner or later, you have to admit, no, I really didn't have a house out there. No, these buildings really weren't unsafe. Sooner or later, that's where you're going to be. You're going to be with somebody saying, yeah, you know, we just made that up because we couldn't think of any other way to put it there. There'll be a point where it's impossible to carry this lie forward. The fact that you're pressuring them on the pretext of building safety to take this seriously, you know, obviously the real reason you're doing that is because you don't take it seriously, and you know damn well there's nothing wrong with those buildings.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so silly, but that's kind of, you know, I mean, I pieced together my approach from Columbo episodes. I mean, this is kind of how it got done on that show, is that you just follow the lie until its conclusion, and then the next ridiculous conclusion until it's so ridiculous that the person lying to you can't possibly keep it up anymore, and they have to admit it, like you said.
The added entertainment value that Columbo always walks up and knows exactly who the criminal is and starts hounding him to death until he confesses. We won't be so fortunate.
Well, and here's the thing. I don't think that Michael Shermer is, like, working for the other side or anything like that. I kind of see a guy who's made a career out of being a professional skeptic, and being a professional skeptic, from what I've seen of this, I don't follow it very closely, but from what I've seen, it's almost joining a certain religion in itself, that there's like a certain line that's thrown out there, and if you're a skeptic, you follow that same line, whether it's 9/11 or
which makes the whole concept of being a skeptic free of any virtue whatsoever. If being a skeptic means following the crowd, any crowd, forget it. That's doesn't mark you in with any distinction at all.
And look, I understand it was the middle of a lecture and he wasn't expecting to be in the middle of a debate, but you should still be able to first have your facts straight, because someone's going to call you out on it, and also be able to defend what you're saying in some way. And see, the problem is with the forums that a lot of these people are presented in don't really allow for any kind of back and forth. I said this one time when I went to go see Hillary Clinton, not because I'm a fan of Hillary Clinton, but because we were holding out signs outside, but to do that you had to buy tickets. So before we did the signs, we wanted to see what it was like. And you couldn't... there was these specifications on who you had to be in order to submit a question. You had to be a student and submit it to your professor, and then the professors had to pick the best ones in their opinion and then give it to a woman who's sitting on the stage with Hillary essentially doing a talk show with her, seemingly. So you have no interaction, and it's all very tightly controlled, and they don't have to be accountable for what they say because the people on stage are being paid to not stir anything up. They're being paid to basically make them look good. It's like an infomercial, and that's kind of...
I have a term for that practice. It's called censorship. It prevents both the dialogue that should be going on. I don't come there to learn from somebody who's there speaking. I come to experience an event, and I don't want it to be one way like I'm watching TV. But that's what they end up doing. They end up making it like you're like that guy's in control of this, and you're there to learn from him. Actually, I'm not.
And Richard Gage, I mean, you know, he does his presentation and then he takes questions from the audience. Now, had this been presented in such a way that you could have some back and forth with somebody, you know, then you patiently wait and you wait to ask your question. Now, I mean, to the radio station and all the people planning this as credit, they did read our question at the end, so that is a good thing. But
they do a lot of things right. Let's give them right. A lot of credit. Here's where I'm being critical of them, but that doesn't... It's, you know, it's not a thoroughgoing criticism. It's criticism of this.
Well, yeah, but there's not an opportunity that when he dodges, like my question right here, a very reasonable question that nobody can argue with, and he goes off and saying, oh, do you think that this other thing is a conspiracy and that other thing? There's no bringing it back to, well, yeah, but what about this very reasonable question that was just asked here? Or without even any opining on it, what do you about this question? Let the audience decide if it's reasonable or not, and let Michael Shermer...
Letting the audience decide if it's reasonable or not is subjecting yourself to a bright light of scrutiny that might come off with you not looking good.
You're talking about Shermer's position, right?
Talking about from the point of view of the person speaking or the hosts right. Who might, you know... have their own reasons for not wanting him challenged too vigorously.
And here's the deal. Like I said, I barely know who Shermer is. It's just an example. It's something that happened this week. It really highlights the big issue that we're facing here is that the general public is largely misinformed about this issue. They don't even know about Building 7's existence, some of them still. The people who do know about it wake up to this, the large majority of them, and say, yeah, you know, it should be reinvestigated. The people who attack us when challenged on the science will simply misrepresent our position, say that we're blaming the government for it, when my question had absolutely nothing to do with blaming the government for doing 9/11.
That's the other thing, is they automatically, they're so addicted to thinking in terms of who did the crime, they never give themselves the opportunity to go through the joy of the investigation itself when you don't know who the perpetrator was. You find a body with a bullet in it, and the next day you read that the victim drowned. You say, hey, there's a bullet in that body. Well, nobody could have gotten anywhere near the body. Nobody had a gun. No gun was found, so, you know... forget about the bullet.
That's a good way of saying it. Yeah. I always say this, you know, a scenario where you find out your neighbor committed suicide, that's sad and terrible. And then a few years later, you find out, yeah, the details were that he shot himself repeatedly in the back of the head with a shotgun. That's not physically possible, I don't think. I mean, maybe there's somebody out there that could come up with some theoretical way, but just for this example, it's really not. I mean, I don't think it's possible. And so you say, hey, that doesn't really make sense. But then the argument that you get back is, well, that was a really highly secure mansion this person was living in. There was no one there. What, are you saying that his wife killed him? You know, because she would have been the only one who had the capabilities to do it. Are you accusing his wife? Well, no, I'm saying that the investigation should be reopened because it's obviously not a suicide from physical forensic evidence.
Or they said he was stabbed, but the autopsy report shows that he was both stabbed and shot. Well, then I'd like to know whether he was shot before or after he was dead. This is the kind of thing. I mean, this is where science doesn't take a back seat to anything. If you find a body with a bullet in it, you're going to look for a gun.
There you go. I love this.
And with Building 7, we have the equivalent of a body with a bullet in it. An event so uniquely characterizable as one kind of event that it takes moving mountains out of your way to try to construct any kind of false narrative. And I believe that that's not an exaggeration to use that analogy, that we have proven, I'll use words that strong, we have proven that Building 7 was a controlled demolition, and we have essentially proven that the other two buildings were also controlled demolitions. We don't need to be hassled forever about, oh, that's a conspiracy. Well, first of all, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's an interpretation of a physical forensic observation. This conspiracy theory comes into it when you start trying to figure out, how did that become like that?
That was essentially his argument at one point, is he said, oh, how could they rig the buildings to explode? Because there was something in that.
It's the old thing, well, nobody could have gotten in the building, so therefore the fact that there's a bullet in the body does not indicate that anybody shot him, because nobody could have done it. Well, that's ludicrous. If there's a bullet, there's a gun.
Well, yeah. Now, I want to get your take on, because the next morning, this must have stung with him. I didn't talk to him afterwards. I left. And, you know, again, it was kind of funny. I just kind of left there shaking my head in absolute amazement that people are paying $15 to go listen to this guy speak and supposedly debunk conspiracy theories and not even know the official story he's defending. But it must have stung with him, because just for the heck of it, I Googled his name. I was actually looking for the video of this, but I Googled his name and put the Google search on last 24 hours, and he had put a Twitter post up of the materials that were being handed out outside the event and made some comment about, just because you can't explain what happened to Building 7 doesn't mean it's a conspiracy, or something to that effect. I don't have it in front of me. Expanding this out, because, you know, we're probably giving Shermer more spotlight than he probably deserves at this moment, and I don't want to just make this about personality.
You know, I don't mind giving it to him.
And then the thing is, it's not even personal. I don't have anything personal against the guy, and it's not. And I'm not one of these people that, you know, focuses on some person that said something about us and makes a big deal of that. But I want to just look at the overall closed-mindedness out there and the strict adherence to an official story and not acknowledging what's in front of you.
And this masquerading as open-mindedness is what you're referring to.
That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Wow, you're the king of one-liners here tonight.
It's not addressing specific things that will help to further the truth and simply dismissing them with irrelevant sarcasm is how I would put it. When I ask a legitimate question about two versions of a final report about Building 7, and he makes sarcastic remarks about umbrellas and JFK and Hitler, what kind of a skeptic would do that?
I want to focus on some activism, because you got some experience in this, and you guys got a great group out here in Northern California doing stuff. That's awesome. So something that I stress, I heard it from a piece of World War II propaganda at one point, but it's applicable for the 9/11 truth movement. Small things done well every day are going to be what wins this war for us. And I do look at it, obviously, as an information war, as so many other people do. So I want to pick your brain. What are some things that our audience can do every day to get the word out about the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence?
Well, I'll tell you what I do, and I don't see a lot of my fellow truthers doing it often enough. Wear blatant T-shirts everywhere you go. Don't be afraid of what people are going to say. Revel in it when they call you a nutcase or a conspiracy theorist. I have gotten into the habit of wearing 9/11 T-shirts at work every day so regularly that if I show up without one on, my boss will tell me that I'm out of uniform. But I've also discovered that everywhere you go, I keep T-shirts in the car to throw on just to walk into the grocery store, so that after a while, people see me and they instantly start calling me 9/11 guy. Even people that never spoke to me about it or anything else, but they say, oh, you're that guy that's always wearing the... Well, guess what? I've gotten through without doing anything. You get the conversation started. I've also taken on something that I find to be just enormously fun, and that is I like to carry a 9/11 truth sign when I'm hiking out on the trails in the local community here. And you wouldn't believe how many conversations I've gotten into, how many thumbs up I've gotten from people, and how many times I've been asked for literature and been told as a parting shot that they can't believe they've never heard this before and that they find me very convincing. I don't know if you think those are good ideas, but I can tell you that I don't go anywhere. I like to go out hiking all the time, so I carry a sign with me. And I run into people, and I do get into conversations all the time about it and because of it. Those are things I do. And, of course, I just talk it up constantly with my friends and neighbors, and family and others, they don't always want to hear it, and so I never go very far overboard dwelling on it. I just like to get a little jab in here and there, because over time, it has the effect of eating away at the mortar that's holding the bricks together. You can't move this thing fast, but if you have patience, you can move it slow.
I am blown away here. You got a lot of charisma, a great voice here, so I don't really have a final question. I'm going to just let you talk to the audience, motivate the people out there. Any final words to get them active, get everyone excited about this very rare opportunity in history to make a real difference by getting the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence out there and getting a real investigation going. What are your final thoughts?
I'll put my final thoughts this way. It is only on me to do what I can do. I try to do it all the time, day in and day out. I try to make it just a part of my day, like breathing, that I'm out there, as one person put it, truthing people. It's just a constant with me. There isn't a person in my life anywhere who doesn't know that I'm a truther. It'd be impossible not to know, because I've made such a ruckus out of it over the last 10 years or more. And I don't know what effect I expect to have. I don't know whether I expect some great moment of truth to come where this thing gets exposed. I don't get to control that. I do get to control my message, and I make sure my message is out there all the time. And each time I'm challenged on something I say, I get mindful of that challenge and think, how will I answer that challenge better if it ever comes around again? I've gotten pretty damn good at some of the common ones, like, oh, it would have taken hundreds of people, somebody would have talked. That kind of nonsense, I'm all over it. No problem. But every now and then you'll hear one you haven't heard before, and it's like, how do I speak to that? So I get better at it every time. And I don't usually bring my credentials into the matter, but anybody who knows me and knows the work that I'm doing and knows the work that I've done over my academic part of my career knows that I bring rational thinking and rational thinking intent and skills into everything. Why would I make an exception about something as dramatic as 9/11? Well, I wouldn't. Bring exactly the same inquisitiveness to that issue that I would bring to try to solve the kinds of problems I'm always trying to solve at work. It's the same mentality. Just a different question.
That is the way to look at it. And again, you got to bring rationality to your arguments, do small things well every day, and the seeds you plant, you might not see them sprout right in front of you, but that doesn't mean they won't later on when you're not looking.
But they sprout. I know that they've sprouted every time somebody comes up to me and talks to me about, say, my T-shirts, because they've noticed them for 5 years. And I didn't even know that person existed.
And folks, you can get T-shirts at the AE 911 Truth store. So you can go right to AE911Truth.org right now and do what Dana's saying. Wear those T-shirts around, wear them proud, and get conversations started everywhere. Dana Carson, thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I hope we'll see you again sometime.
This program's on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also download MP3s of this show from the Internet Archive by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele saying have a great week and good luck.